So, you guys have talked a lot about sort of bipartisanship, and we've just seen attempts at bipartisan immigration reform fall apart, an issue that both parties in many ways agree on. And now the president is preparing to take executive action, sort of a different branch taking action, which seems somewhat analogous to the work that you did on gay marriage, where one branch, I don't know if you would call it the people a branch, but sort of democracy and the proposition failed, and so you went through the court system. So I'm curious, both as lawyers and people who think about sort of the state of American politics, what you think about this potential for like major executive action on immigration reform.
I think that the system is broken. There's no doubt about that. But I think one of the things that we have to keep in mind is that the great genius of this country and of the American system is that we combine two critical principles. One is the principle of democracy, where you let the people decide questions. And second, it's the principle of fundamental rights, where you take certain issues away from the people. And you say certain rights are so fundamental that you're not going to let any majority take away those rights. That's what was at issue more than half a century ago in the fight for racial justice in this country that's still going on. That's what was at issue in the fight for marriage equality. That's what is at issue in many of the cases that we bring to courts, because courts are what vindicate those fundamental rights. But in every area other than fundamental rights, it's important to respect the principles of democracy, even when it's messy and even when it's inefficient. And I think that the critical question that you get to, and I'm not sure what the answer is on immigration reform, but the critical question that you get to in areas like executive action is how far is the executive branch going beyond the power that it's given under the Constitution, because we have separated powers for a reason. It is a reason that may not be as clear in the 20th century as it was in the 18th century, but it's a division of powers, a separation of powers that has served this country very well. And so we've got to be very careful that executive action doesn't become a substitute for democracy. That's what the separation of powers was designed to prevent more than 200 years ago. And so I'm as impatient as anyone for immigration reform, but I'd like to see it come through the democratic process. And I'd like to see the two parties, and maybe after this next election, the parties will come together, because immigration reform, like marriage equality, is an idea that is going to come, in my view. And the party or the principals or the legislators that try to stop that are eventually going to get run over. And I hope everybody can get together, but I'm cautious about the idea of substituting executive action for democratic action, even in areas like this where I think everybody would agree reform is important.
And I agree with David, absolutely. We didn't rehearse any of this, obviously, but it will let those people that we elect to do this off the hook. They will then blame the president for exceeding the president's authority, or they'll certainly make that argument. It will take the pressure off of the elected representative, including members of my own party, to get the job done. They've got to do that. And so I think I agree with David that this is an issue that the president needs to be very careful about.
There's a hand up, but I came to the mic. Sorry, I hope I'm not.
Go ahead, and then okay. We'll come back here.
My name is Angela Rye. I'm a political strategist based in D.C., so this is fascinating, particularly in this day and age. And I hear you all referencing immigration reform, but I want to take you back to last summer, where there was this Prop 8 challenge, and it was successful. And then the week thereafter, the Voting Rights Act was virtually gutted. And I'm curious from the standpoint of, and no offense to Justice Kennedy, because I know he's here, but
he's not. He told us he was, no offense, but he was going to leave the room while we were speaking. And I suggested...
Even better.
Because of these issues and so forth. And sure. I suggested to him he didn't want to be exposed to our persuasive power.
Well, it sounds like he was last summer. So I guess my question is, from a voting rights standpoint, where we very well expect that to be back before the Supreme Court, and from another issue that I'm very passionate about, I'm sure others are as well, is affirmative action. So I wonder if this odd couple strategy works on issues beyond a Prop 8 issue, and how we can encourage advocates to consider not just waiting for their opportunity to have the Supreme Court platform, but to really consider that opportunity to argue cases and these types of issues, to utilize something that's outside the box so that we're effective in our winning strategy and approach.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And I think Ralph Nader has a book out now called, what's it called, the name of that book? But he talks about it's inevitable or irreversible or something like that. When if you want to get something done, get people on the opposite ends of the political spectrum, figure out how they can come together. We can talk about, we can disagree about the decision of the Supreme Court with respect to dividing the country up into little pockets that are subject to different rules at the Justice Department and all those preclearance thing. We can talk about that, whether that's a right or wrong decision. We can talk about whether the affirmative action decisions from the Supreme Court, which has generated something like 25 different opinions by individual justices over the last 25 years. But the answer to that is to sit down in a room and say, well, don't we agree that everybody should vote? Don't we agree that there shouldn't be impediments to vote? Don't we agree that our universities and other parts of our country are better off with people of all backgrounds? That's what this country is all about. Well, we do agree with that. So, well, okay, then how can we get that done? So, but that the dialogue starts with the reasons why people don't want to do things, and then it goes downhill from there. Now, don't expect too much from us here, okay?
Yeah. We have a question here from Dr. Watson.
Justice in some way conveyed by our genes as to what is right or wrong. And we have traditionally said that they come from a god. But, there's just no evidence for any gods. And so I refuse to accept that. On the other hand, I do have a sense of what justice is.
From our standpoint as lawyers, it's less important where those fundamental rights came from than that we respect those fundamental rights, because I think we have seen through history that whether those are a product of our genes, that is, through evolution, whether this is a concept of justice and society and community, is something that we evolve through in order to survive in a hostile environment, or whether they are principles from a divine being, is less important than the fact that we know from history that they are essential to human happiness, human satisfaction, the development of the kind of society we all want to live in. And so from our standpoint, the fundamental rights come from the Constitution. And how they got into the Constitution is raises fundamental questions of religion and science. But for lawyers, once they're in the Constitution, and once we know how important they are, that becomes the starting point.
And as another lawyer would say, you are asking the wrong guys the right question, but the wrong guys. We're just lawyers. We can read the Declaration of Independence that said we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and endowed by their Creator. But as lawyers, we are sort of, in a sense, advocates and mechanics and not philosophers. We're not very good at it, but it is something that we do think about. We thought about a lot during the Proposition 8 case because it was so important to convey to people their sense of rightness, of sense of justice, the sense of humanity to our fellow men, brothers, and sisters.
We have time for one more question.
I'm going to play Sunday talk show host on a Saturday. And I want to follow up on one answer and ask you two questions, though. First of all, on the question of executive action, you both expressed discomfort with it. Is it more than that? And in fact, do you think it would be unconstitutional and a breach of the separation of powers for the president to, in effect, take something like delaying deportation for millions of Americans on his own without congressional buy-in, I guess is the word. And on the question of same-sex marriage, and you talk about the fact that there have been specific decisions made, but the fight is not over, the cause is not over, given, and I'm really asking you almost more as court watchers than as advocates, given the current makeup of the court, what do you think are the prospects that this court would decide that there was, in fact, a constitutional, generalized constitutional right to same-sex marriage?
Which of the hard Chris Wallace questions?
Yeah, I was going to say.
When he does this on the air, he says, and you have 30 seconds to answer.
Well, I would say the answers are yes and no. I just very, very quickly, I think, and I'm glad Justice Kennedy is not here because I wouldn't want to be presumptuous, but I think the likelihood is very great that this court will find a fundamental right to marriage under the due process and equal protection clauses. I think if you read the opinions of the Supreme Court, which Justice Kennedy has authored, the Windsor case, the Lawrence case, to some extent the Romer case, all three cases over the last 10 years have expanded the rights of gay and lesbian citizens under the Constitution. If you read the reasoning of those cases, I think you have to conclude. Since the decisions that Ted talked about a little over a year ago, 21 district courts around the country, appointed by three Republican presidents, two Democratic presidents, have considered whether there's a fundamental right to marriage equality. 20 of those 21 federal district judges have decided in favor of that fundamental right. Three courts of appeals, Court of Appeals for the states of Utah and Oklahoma, for Wisconsin and Illinois and Indiana, and for Virginia, not necessarily hotbeds of liberalism. All three of those courts of appeals have decided in favor of the fundamental right to marriage. So I think the answer to the question is, I'm hopeful, but I actually think it will happen. With respect to the constitutionality of the immigration executive action, the executive is given the power to decide whether to enforce the law and when to enforce the law. And the concept of prosecutorial discretion is something that's very frustrating to defense lawyers, but it's something that's well embedded in the law. And I don't think, my personal view is I don't think that the executive action that, as I understand, is contemplated is probably unconstitutional. But I think it is unwise. I think that you don't want to push the limits of the power of any one of the three branches. And I agree 100% with Ted. Don't take people off the hook. You don't want this imposed on the country. You don't want this imposed in a way that makes people say this was one person's political decision. You want to make the legislators do their job, which is immigration reform, so that the entire country can get behind it. Just like in Bush v. Gore, just like in marriage equality, just like in the case of the fight for racial justice. Just establishing the law is not enough. You've got to bring the people with you, and you're much more likely to do that if you're doing it through congressional action than through executive branch action.
And I'll just say one thing. I agree with David with respect to marriage equality. I think this is going to come. We feel so strong that it is the right answer. And those federal judges, that's 7 out of 9 circuit court judges, appellate court judges, and 20 out of 21 district court judges, they're reading the Supreme Court's decisions and coming out the way they're coming out. With respect to immigration, it does depend upon what it is that he does. And he does have the president authority under Article 2 of the Constitution faithfully to execute the laws. It's pretty vague what that is. But as David said, if he pushes it too far, he loses in court, he loses a lot. The recess appointments, which is a little esoteric, but it was a Supreme Court decision just a few months ago. The president, when the Senate was allegedly or arguably in recess, but not really, made appointments under the recess clause, and the United States Supreme Court 9-0 said that he didn't have the power to do that. That's a big step back for presidential power, and I would think that the lawyers in the White House and the Justice Department that are giving him advice remind him that some of these cases do get to court, and if you go too far, you'll lose the authority that you do have.